Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Attorney General's reversal of an Obama-era policy restraining federal prosecutors in states that have legalized marijuana from bringing charges. Mark Kleiman, a professor of public policy at New York University, where he leads the Crime and Justice Program, joins us to discuss Jeff Sessions' peculiar obsession about what he sees as a greater scourge than the opioid epidemic, marijuana, which the AG likens to heroin, and the furious backlash from Colorado's Republican Senator Cory Gardner, who accused Sessions of violating promises he had made and threatened retaliation. Then we'll assess the importance of the explosive admission by Steve Bannon in the new book Fire and Fury, which Trump is trying to suppress. Bannon's belief that Mueller's probe, quote, is all about money laundering, suggesting that the special counsel's, quote, path to effing Trump goes right through Paul Manafort, Don Jr., and Jared Kushner. They're going to roll those guys. And Bannon goes on to say that Mueller will crack Don Jr. like an egg on national TV. An expert on international money laundering, James Henry, the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and author of Blood Bankers, joins us to discuss how, after being blackballed by Wall Street, money laundering became the Trump business model with an open invitation to Russian gangsters, kleptocrats, oligarchs, and assorted third world looters to invest in the Trump family real estate projects. Buttressing Bannon's warning, we'll also discuss the New York Times op-ed by the heads of Fusion GPS, who urged congressional investigators to look into Trump's Russian money laundering, an effort which fell on deaf Republican ears. Then finally, we'll speak with Clay Calvert, the Brechner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication and Director of the First Amendment Project at the University of Florida. He joins us to discuss Trump's litigious effort to silence Bannon with a cease and desist warning and his attack on the new book by Michael Wolff that contains the widely quoted remarks of Bannon's, which portray an unqualified and ignorant leader and first family in the White House. We will assess what appears to be a futile threat by Trump's lawyer, who is demanding that the publisher immediately cease and desist the publication of the book, which is already number one on Amazon's bestseller list. And joining us now is Mark Kleiman, a professor of public policy at the New York University Mellon School of Urban Management and at NYU's Wagner, where he leads the Crime and Justice Program. He's the author of Marijuana, Costs of Abuse, Costs of Control. He also edits the Drug Policy Analysis Bulletin and has worked for the United States Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Kleiman.
Thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Mark. And what are we to make of the priorities of the Attorney General? To begin with, just a few days ago, Donald Trump attacked the entire Department of Justice, all these career prosecutors, by calling them in a tweet the Deep State Department of Justice. The head of the DOJ, the Attorney General, did not come to the rescue of his insulted rank and file, has been totally silent on it. But now he's come out today to rescind a Barack Obama-era policy, which he had promised not to do. At least that's what Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado is saying. He was absolutely furious.
I believe it's the case that Mr. Trump had promised not to do that during the campaign.
Trump is on record, on video, in campaigning in Colorado. He was asked about it,
right,
and he said, "I'm a states person," meaning I'm a states' right person, and right. I won't touch the marijuana project. So,
right. So that was Trump's commitment, not Sessions's.
Right.
So I don't think Gardner can claim that Sessions has broken his word.
Well, he said he broke his word to him. Yeah. I mean, he had promised him before Sessions' confirmation that he would stick.
That
he would stick with the Cole
memo
or whatever it's called.
So let's talk
about that just to understand what has happened and what regime existed. The so-called Cole memo is named after the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, who issued it, James Cole. And it basically instructs federal prosecutors to deprioritize marijuana-related prosecutions in states that have legalized marijuana, right?
Well, to deprioritize prosecutions of activities permitted under those state laws.
Right.
Unless they trench on one of eight named federal priorities.
So what's going to happen now? That obviously,
nothing.
You don't. But isn't that already having a chill on the business model? That you know, they just legalized marijuana a couple of days ago here in California.
Yes, and it'll stay quite legal. I mean, that is to say, it will stay just as illegal as it was, right? I mean, all of that activity going on under state law wasn't as illegal under federal law. That's just a fact.
Mm-hmm.
When my group was working with the what's now the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board, setting up their legal market, I kept reminding people, look, we're issuing state licenses to commit federal felonies. And so there's no doubt whatsoever that federal law remains valid, even in the states that have legalized. All they can do is get rid of the state statute bar to selling or possessing cannabis. There's equally no doubt that the states have a perfect right to do that. Right? It's black letter constitutional law. The federal government may not require a state to make something criminal or to help enforce a federal criminal law. So the states are acting strictly within their rights to license the cannabis business. And the federal government would be acting strictly within its rights to enforce its law just the same. After all, there are lots of things that are against federal law that aren't against state law. And that doesn't make them sort of legal. A friend of mine gave the right example. Under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, if an official of IBM, for example, bribes an official of Nigerian government, that's a federal felony. But it's not against the law in New York State. I mean, New York State doesn't have a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It would be strange to say that the federal government was doing something wrong in enforcing its law just because the state didn't have the same law. What's complicated here is that the Controlled Substances Act instructs the Attorney General to cooperate with the states. And so where the states have decided to regulate rather than prohibiting, I think he's under a fairly clear obligation to acquiesce in that, and that's apparently the decision that the Obama Justice Department made. But whatever the legal merits of the case, there's a much more important practical issue, which is the Drug Enforcement Administration has 4,000 agents worldwide. There are 500,000 state and local cops. There are probably 50,000 state and local cops in California. There's no way the federal government can actually enforce that law without the help of state authorities. So they could shut down the legal industry in California, because all those people, you know, file paperwork and have licenses. But then they couldn't do anything about the illegal business.
If the feds ever followed this through and arrested dispensaries, et cetera, if they went to trial, their jury pool would be citizens who voted to legalize marijuana.
In some places that would be true. In other places it wouldn't. I mean, I'm not sure what the vote was like in the Central Valley, for example.
Right. Well, but statewide it was pretty overwhelming, and it has been that way.
But the jury pool is chosen from the federal judicial district,
right?
Not statewide. They might or might not get a conviction. Assuming that a U.S. attorney wanted to waste his resources on this. I mean, the Sessions memo does not instruct anybody to do anything. So what he says is he's returning the discretion to the United States attorneys, right? The presidentially appointed official in each of 94 judicial districts who runs federal prosecution for that district. They have complete discretion, and I think most of them are going to say, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
Now, look, I can imagine a situation where a local DEA office will have a reason to want to make a case, and then it's going to be a tough call for the U.S. attorney about whether to prosecute that case or not. And yes, I noticed that the wildly overpriced stocks in the cannabis industry took a hit today. But my guess is the most important practical consequence of Sessions' decision will be increased Democratic turnout in the 2018 election.
And again, I'm speaking with, I'm just going to reintroduce you, Mark.
Yeah.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Kleiman, the professor of public policy at the New York University Mehran Institute of Urban Management and at NYU Wagner, where he leads the Crime and Justice Program. He's the author of Marijuana, Costs of Abuse, Costs of Control, and edits the Drug Policy Analysis Bulletin, and also worked for the U.S. Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. Sorry, what were you going to say, Mark?
I think the most likely consequence here is to help Democrats in 2018. I mean, if Sessions had been on the Democratic National Committee payroll, I'm not sure what he could have done.
Right. Well,
more favorable to that cause.
Well, then the question would be, to some extent, you can make that argument that Donald Trump is also probably going to help turnout.
Yes.
But still, it seems that what happened, you mentioned that there's always been this, the fact that it's always been a against the law, against federal law, but states have legalized it. And that reconciliation has not happened. But to some extent, I suppose Obama tried to finesse it, deciding not to sue these states and set up this regime, and now it's been reversed, right? This accommodation, the Kohl memo.
Right.
But you don't think it's a big deal, just in the broadest sense?
Well, I mean, I doubt that it will have much impact on cannabis commerce.
Mm-hmm.
If the Justice Department had decided to make war on the state legal industry back in 2012, when it was just Colorado and Washington, they would have had a more plausible shot. But the notion of the federal government trying to enforce cannabis laws in California barehanded is just is beyond silly.
So, is this a personal obsession of Jeff Sessions? Because we do have a manifest opioid crisis in this country, and you can trace it to the source, which is what the DEA does. They always go after the drug kingpins and the drug labs, and they used to defoliate. Maybe they still defoliate the jungles of South and Central America to go after the source. Well, the source, of course, for prescription drugs is largely Purdue Pharma. That's an easy address to find. What's Sessions doing about the opioid crisis when he seems to be obsessed with marijuana, which is like, you know, water under the bridge, you know?
That's the way it seems to me. He's a conventional but very extreme cultural conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Does
one man's personal, political, and moral stance, is that powerful enough to change the entire Justice Department and U.S. government?
I think under a different administration, this would have had to get cleared at the White House.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, if Steve Bannon of blessed memory were still there, he probably would have pointed out that cannabis is a lot more popular than Donald Trump at the moment, and this is not a smart thing to do.
Right.
So partly this is, I think, Sessions freelancing when nobody's watching.
Because Donald Trump is distracted tweeting and trying to stop the publication of a book that's already the number one bestseller.
And has utterly failed to set up the normal channels of decision-making that constrain cabinet officers not to do things that the president promised not to do. And now, look, it's not surprising if somebody changes his mind after a campaign promise.
Right.
But you would have expected some amount of clearance from the White House on this. Sessions didn't even bother to recite that he had Trump's support.
Right.
So it looks to me like he's just freelancing. Look, there may be some prosecutions. I can imagine.
Right. But you don't expect Trump to step in. I mean,
I've done many stupid things in my life.
Yeah.
But predicting the actions of Donald Trump.
No,
thanks.
Right. Bannon, of course.
One thing that is worth, and then again, it wasn't mentioned today. So there are a couple of things that Sessions could have said that he did not say that suggest to me that this is just his political posturing, that he doesn't really mean it.
Right.
Well, so he didn't say anything about injunctions.
Hmm.
He also didn't say anything about the fact that there are about 4,000 assistant U.S. attorneys in the 94 judicial districts. There's also a staff of about 400 attorneys, prosecutors, in the main criminal division in Washington. Right, so those aren't part of the U.S. attorney system.
Right.
And their authority is national. And so there is a narcotic section of the criminal division. I worked for those guys 30 years ago. It would certainly be within Sessions' powers to say to them, go to DEA and let's make some cannabis cases against some of the big state legal growers or retailers. And he has complete power to do that. He didn't say that he was going to do that. The memo refers entirely to the United States attorneys.
Well, but we just have to wrap it up now. But if Trump doesn't have too many Republican senators, he can afford to alienate, and he's already got Cory Gardner mad as hell, and all the states' rights guys like, Rand Paul and others are against this as well. So, I think the whole thing is, I think you put your finger on it, Mark, that this is Sessions freelancing, and nobody's minding the store in the White House. So. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Kleiman, who is the professor of public policy at the New York University Maron Institute of Urban Management and at the NYU Wagner, where he leads the Crime and Justice Program. He's the author of Marijuana, Costs of Abuse, Costs of Control, and he edits the Drug Policy Analysis Bulletin and also worked for the U.S. Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into Bannon's belief that the Mueller probe is all about money laundering.
My choice is what I choose to do. And if I'm causing no harm, it shouldn't bother you. Your choice is who you choose to be. And if you're causing no harm, then you're all right with me. If you don't light my fire, then don't come around.
No, in the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thank you, James. And the bombshell book that Donald Trump is trying to stop the publication of has extensive quotes from Stephen Bannon. But one of the more damaging ones is when he refers to Javanka, as he calls them, Jared and Ivanka, and Don Jr. being vulnerable. Just a quote from the book. You realize, talking about the Mueller investigation, you realize where this is going. This is all about money laundering. Mueller chose Andrew Weissman first, and he's a money laundering guy. Their path to effing Trump goes right through Paul Manafort, Don Jr., and Jared Kushner. It's as plain as the hair on your face. It goes through Deutsche Bank, and all the Kushner expletive is greasy. They're going to go right through that. They're going to roll those guys up and say, play me or trade me. What do you make of that?
Well, this is the thing that Manafort is complaining about in the lawsuit he just filed against Mueller, claiming that he's expanding the scope of his investigation beyond the original mandate, which is to look at collusion in the 2016 election, and is now going on to look at things like money laundering. I think that's probably a lawsuit that Manafort will lose, but it's clear that they are very worried about the money laundering allegations, because precisely because they do bring in folks like Kushner, who has interesting, to say the least, connections with foreign investors. We've identified a number of them. Deutsche Bank was also involved heavily in financing not only Russian investments, but also Deutsche Bank ended up being the Donald Trump's sole global bank lender of any note, had extensive connections with Russia. So there's a lot to look at with respect to these money laundering investigations. Felix Sater, who is another business partner of Donald Trump's, Russian mobster, also had, we've discovered, extensive money laundering operations through the Netherlands with firms that were set up for Kazakhstan kleptocrats who were investing in the Trump Soho. There's enormous amount of stuff that's just been coming out in the last 6 months or so about the extent of this money laundering operation. So I can see why the administration is worried.
Well, another shoe that dropped a couple of days ago, of course, was the op-ed in the New York Times by the heads of Fusion GPS, the people who generated the so-called Steele dossier. They basically went public because they've given 21 hours of testimony to the various Republican-controlled committees, the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, and instead of making these transcripts public, there have been selective leaks from the House Intelligence Committee trying to damage these guys and make the case that the Steele dossier, which is the source of they're trying to make it the reason why there's a Mueller investigation and that Mueller's depending on it, and it's all basically been generated by Hillary Clinton, when in fact we've just learned recently, of course, that the inquiry into the Russian meddling into the elections came via George Papadopoulos having drinks with an Australian diplomat. But
yep.
In this op-ed, though, just to quote a bit of it to give you an idea of how similar it is to what we're just talking about in this explosive new book, just a quote from the op-ed, the Fusion guys are talking about going to Congress. They say, we suggested to the Congress that investigators look into the bank records of Deutsche Bank and others that were funding Mr. Trump's businesses. Congress appears uninterested in that tip. Reportedly, the only bank records the House Intelligence Committee ever subpoenaed are ours. We told Congress that from Manhattan to Sunny Isle Beach, Florida, and from Toronto to Panama, we found widespread evidence that Mr. Trump and his organization had worked with a wide array of dubious Russians in arrangements that often raise questions about money laundering. Likewise, those deals don't seem to interest Congress. And then and then when they talk about who Steele is and why they hired him, but they didn't tell Steele who he was working for or who the dossier was for. We gave Steele no specific marching orders beyond this basic question. Why did Mr. Trump repeatedly seek to do deals in a notoriously corrupt police state that most serious investors shun? Now, that seems to me to be a really key question. What do you think?
Well, I've been writing about, Donald Trump's dubious connections with private Russian and foreign sort of former Soviet Union money for the last year or so in The American Interest and in other publications. You don't really have to rely on the Steele memo for this. You can look at the extraordinary amount of information that was just out there and ready to be collated. Steele adds to that database, but you know, it is pretty clear that there's a cover-up going on here on the part of the Republican-chaired House Intelligence Committee. And, they're just, Nunes has gotten back in the driver's seat and is trying to keep all of this testimony that he's collected secret. And he's also banned the Democrats from being able to interview any number of key witnesses that they'd like to call.
Right. So, and by the way, yesterday, Rod Rosenstein, who's in charge of the investigation and oversees it, he went to paid a visit to Speaker Ryan's office because Nunes is demanding all of the information that Mueller has collected so far, all of the interviews, all of the transcripts, all of the FBI investigations, clearly to pass them on to the White House, which is what he did before.
Yeah, he's just an intermediary for the White House, and Trump can't get access to that stuff unless Nunes helps him out. So, I think at this point the strategy for Mueller, I think, is pretty clear. You know, it would take a long time to have an impeachment proceeding, and it requires many more Democrats in the House and Senate than there are. But what could put some interesting pressure on Donald Trump is if his close relatives and family members like Jared and Donald Jr. are implicated in some of these conversations and also in some of the business dealings that we've come across that actually do amount to pretty much outright money laundering. So this is, I think, the strategy that they're concerned about. The next step here is really going to be critical because Donald Trump is now under pressure, even from his own former chief strategist, to come clean about these transactions. And we're going to see some kind of showdown here pretty quickly between the Mueller organization. I mean, Donald Trump has said that he would not close down the Mueller investigation, but I think that these new developments are creating new pressures on him.
Well, clearly going after this book and trying to suppress its publication is an act of desperation. And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he's a co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and he's the author of Blood Bankers. But just to sort of try and simplify things, because it's a tangled tale here and it gets more and more tangled, right. It seems to me pretty obvious that Donald Trump, who took down a bunch of banks, had about four or five bankruptcies, was blacklisted by Wall Street. We know from Donald Trump Jr. Saying that we suddenly found the place to go to get money, and you need money in the real estate business. Obviously, you need credit. You go to, he said it's Russia, and they went to Russia. And that's what the Fusion guys are saying in their op-ed to the New York Times about what they discovered and what Steele discovered. And that's, to my mind, it's so obvious. That is Trump's business model, to launder money for kleptocrats, mostly Russians, but also Indonesians, Filipinos, Turks, you name it. Any dictator around the world, any bunch of scumbags with a whole bunch of dirty money, Donald Trump will launder your money and you'll end up with real estate, whether it's in Trump Tower in Manhattan or in the big Panama Hotel that's entirely dedicated to money laundering.
Well, one of the things we looked at with respect to, a specific Russian oligarchs was a guy named Ribolovlev, the Potash star. Conveniently enough, he comes along in 2008 and buys Donald Trump's house in Palm Beach for $95 million, which is more than twice what Trump paid for it 4 years earlier, just at the moment when Trump is having enormous problems with his creditors and, is personally on the hook for $40 million. So this fellow, just to name one example, ends up being a big investor in the Bank of Cyprus, where Wilbur Ross is also later becomes vice chairman. He bird dogs the president on the campaign trail in his Airbus 319. He ends up being a business partner of KGB and officers who were also investors in the Bank of Cyprus. The Bank of Cyprus turns up being chaired by the former chairman of Deutsche Bank, as we speak, a guy who presided over it during this whole period, and a guy named Joseph Ackerman. So, there's certainly a lot of look at here if the Congress or Mueller were so inclined, and I hope they Mueller at least will get on with the money laundering and sort of financial crimes side of this, because there's a lot to look at. Every single Trump project that we've identified, Trump Toronto, Trump Soho, Panama Ocean Club, his projects in Baku, these are all filled to the gills with dubious money.
Well, as I say, that seems to be the business model, and we know, you've got condo in New York. You can't just buy a condo in a building without the approval of the tenants, and it seems that Donald Trump just simply open for business. It didn't matter how much money you'd stolen from whatever country you came from, as long as you were welcome in Trump Tower, the whole place. They even had a weekly poker game with a bunch of Russian gangsters in Trump Tower.
That's right. I mean, I think a lot of this goes way beyond what is in the Steele memorandum. It's pretty hard to argue with the case that Donald Trump based his recovery after 2000 on. It wasn't that he had investments in Russia. That's the point he keeps arguing. It was that he was benefiting from all this flight capital and GARC money and money laundering that was coming out of the former Soviet Union, countries like Kazakhstan, where you have kleptocrats investing directly in the Trump Soho to launder money. So it's that whole set of connections that are really, Trump is not Putin's mole. He is a mobster. that's the point. And he behaves that way in all of his opportunistic dealings.
Well, so is Bannon correct in what he's quoted in this new book saying that they're going to get him on money laundering and they're going to get Jared and Don Jr.?
I think if
he said, by the way, he said they're going to crack him like an egg, talking about Don Jr. on national TV.
I don't like to agree with Steve Bannon on anything, and as I've said, much of this depends on whether Mueller can survive under the onslaught of the president and people like Manafort, who is suing him actively to try to close down the investigation, and also the Congress is not being helpful. So, right. This is too close to call, really, in terms of how it's going to turn out. But I would have to say that Bannon is right from the standpoint of objectively speaking. There's an awful lot of ostensible criminal activity that should have been investigated before Donald Trump ever ran for office, but certainly now, if we have the chance.
Well, the book, largely quoting Bannon, Trump is trying to stop the publication of. Bannon calls... First of all, he calls him Ivanka, but he calls Ivanka dumb as a brick. And the book describes the total cluelessness of Jared Kushner. and being constantly overridden by his father-in-law. And it just the portrait of him is just this completely vapid sort of functionary who has been given all these amazing jobs along with the daughter. They don't, both of them don't have a clue. I mean, this is a total embarrassment. But this
guy, it's odd to say that this is the first whistleblower we've had in this situation,
right.
Really.
Well, that's why Trump wants to stop it, you know, because it's...
Exactly. Well, I don't think there's any chance of any U.S. court, so long as there's a First Amendment, issuing a pre-publication injunction against the publication. It's just not going to happen. That lawsuit, if he files it, would be written for just one client and one audience.
But the point I wanted to make was that apart from the fact that these people are so woefully unqualified and given such responsibility and are just so vapid and embarrassing, nevertheless, this hasn't stopped Jared Kushner from running around the world as a so-called peace emissary in the Middle East, shaking down the Saudis. I know Ivanka got $100 million from the boy king of Saudi Arabia. My understanding is that Jared also tried to shake down the Qatari Al Thani royals for $500 million for this underwater building he has at 666 Fifth Avenue, on which there is a $1.2 billion balloon payment due at the end of this year.
Well, it's a delicious spectacle for those of us who are critical of Trump to watch. But I sort of, you know, I'm very sad for the United States as a whole. This isn't, a salutary kind of spectacle for anyone who cares about our constitutional democracy. I'm a little bit shocked that Wall Street, is just off and running, and quite happy with the kind of the tax bill. We call it the tax heist that he's passed, and doesn't seem to care, or at least there's not a lot of critical voice coming out of business circles these days. They seem to be celebrating the record stock market that we have. Those of us who care about civil liberties and, I think, democratic government are right to be concerned that this is going to be a testing time for how our, system of government is able to rein in and make sure that the president can't exercise any kind of ability to obstruct justice and to close down investigations. So,
well, but above and beyond that, James Henry, the reason that Trump is so upset about this book is that it actually is a window into this appalling, dysfunctional White House, this embarrassing bunch of amateurs, idiots, crooks, con men, the worst kind of people in charge of the United States, and the people that are professionals around them have total contempt for them. I imagine the Wall Street people, they've always looked down on politicians because they're for hire and they buy them. So they're hirelings. But they're all missing the point is that the United States needs a president. We can't function with somebody so dangerous and reckless and unqualified. Obviously, he's a perfect president for the Koch brothers. I mean, he's made to order. He's clueless. He'll do anything they say,
Well, Michael Wolff is going to be on NBC tomorrow morning and expanding on some of this, but there's already been some reporting in which he elaborated on some of the themes in the book, and certainly his descriptions of, Trump's kind of radical incompetence. So there's a lot of detail there that we're going to have to pay attention to. I'm more struck by this issue about Mueller, and I think that's because that ultimately goes to the question of how we shorten this fellow's time in office while respecting the Constitution. And I think that's the key thing here. All of these, sort of innuendos and salacious remarks, I mean, that's fine for a Hollywood reporter, and that's what you'd expect. But I think we need to take it up a notch and be concerned about the balance of power here and how we actually can make progress with this Congress.
Well, it's worse than the balance of power. There's no balance. There's no separation of power. The Congress is just not doing its job. It's not doing it. It's not a check and balance against the executive branch. They're just completely rolling over for this crook and incompetent. But just in closing, you're going to be on CNN when?
There's a documentary tomorrow night at 10 o'clock Eastern Time.
That's Friday night at 10 o'clock Eastern. CNN.
And there's a, you know, that will go into some of these themes in more detail. And we're turning up more, you know, live cases for Mueller to investigate every day. So, you know, stay tuned.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, James Henry.
Great. Good to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist. He's written extensively about global banking, debt crisis, and tax havens. He's the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company and the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and the author of Blood Bankers. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing Trump's litigious efforts to silence Bannon and the cease and desist warning against the publishers of the new book by Michael Wolff, Fire and Fury. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Clay Calvert, the Brechner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication and Director of the Marion B. Brechner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida. He's authored or co-authored more than 130 law journal articles on topics related to freedom of expression. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clay Calvert.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And what do you make of, first of all, Trump's lawyers send a cease and desist letter to Bannon, which was essentially a hollow gesture, I think, or an empty threat. But now they're also trying to stop the publication of this book, Fire and Fury, Inside the Trump White House, by Michael Wolff. Excerpts of it have appeared in a number of magazines, and of course it's been grist for the mill on cable TV. But apparently Trump's lawyer is saying that it gives rise to claims for libel that could result in substantial monetary damages and punitive damages. Mr. Trump hereby demands that you immediately cease and desist from any further publication, release, or dissemination of the book, the article, or any excerpts or summaries of either of them to any person or entity, and that you issue a full and complete retraction and apology to my client as to all statements made about him in the book and article that lack competent evidentiary support. So that's a pretty ambitious broadside they're firing at the Henry Holt Company and the author. But now we hear that the publishers are going to move the publication date forward and the book's going to be available on Friday, and it's already an Amazon bestseller.
So exactly. I think basically this is just a lot of bluster and bombast and posturing by Charles Harder, who is the attorney for Donald Trump here. The remedy for speech that you don't like is not a prior restraint. And essentially that's what Trump is asking for here, a prior restraint to stop the publication of the book before it can come out. The remedy in the United States, at least, for things that are libelous is not a prior restraint, not to stop it before it comes out, but what we call a subsequent punishment, to sue for libel afterwards, because it may turn out that the statements are actually true. So the remedy is, again, in the United States, not to stop the book before it can come out, but to allow it to come out. And then, if indeed material in it is false and defamatory to Trump, such that it would harm his reputation, then Trump's remedy and Charles Harder as his attorney would be able to sue for defamation. So the odds on this succeeding, these threatening letters, basically, these cease and desist letters that Harder has been sending both to Bannon and to the publisher of the book, the odds of those succeeding are slim to none.
So wouldn't it also, at the end of the day, result, if he were successful in any way, Trump, or at least had his day in court, he'd be liable to cross-examination, wouldn't he? And I would think that could prove to be even more embarrassing than the revelations in the book.
That's exactly right. So the plaintiff in a defamation action, in this case, Trump would be the plaintiff if he were to sue over the book. The plaintiff has the burden of proving that the statements were false. Yes, you're correct. Trump would have his deposition taken, basically a one-on-one, face-to-face interview taken by the counsel for the publisher of the book and any other defendants that Trump chooses to sue, were he to actually sue, and I doubt that will really happen, but if he did. So, yes, and during the deposition, then the attorneys for the publisher of the book would be able to ask Trump any wide range of questions, provided that they're somewhat relevant, minimally at least, to the question of defamation and why he is suing here. So, yes, he would open himself up to a broad side of questions that he probably doesn't want to have to answer, especially because a deposition has the same force and effect as if the testimony were in a court of law. So he is under oath during a deposition, and he would certainly be questioned about that. And again, that deposition would take place earlier, long before trial. It's part of what we call the discovery process. So, yes, I don't think Trump wants to have a deposition taken. We've seen presidents, like, remember President Clinton's deposition taken in the Monica Lewinsky situation. And, you know, these are highly embarrassing for presidents to have a deposition taken. It would be videotaped. It would be audiotaped. It would be transcribed. And it subjects him to any number of questions on anything as long as it's somewhat relevant to the question of defamation.
And again, I'm speaking with Clay Calvert, who is the Brechner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication and Director of the Marion B. Brechner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida. He's authored or co-authored more than 130 law journal articles on topics related to freedom of expression. So why do you think Trump is doing this? Because it seems at the end of the day, this is just going to help the book sales. If it's futile, if the barn door's already open and the horse is down the paddock, why do you think he's doing it?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, what you're tapping into initially is what, you know, they call the Streisand effect after Barbara Streisand. By calling attention to this, he's actually bringing more exposure to the book and promoting its sales. Had he not commented on it at all, maybe perhaps the book would not sell as much or be as popular, or as you suggested, now it's coming out 4 days in advance of the original publication date. So certainly the Streisand effect, the negative aspect here, that it, he's actually calling more attention to something that he would rather have not people see, is ironic on Trump's part. I think this is partly to get back at Steve Bannon, who was a large source for the book, is my understanding. And obviously they have had, you know, not been on great terms since Bannon left, I believe it was in April. So I think part of this is also Trump just pandering and posturing his normal bluster that he engages in anytime he doesn't like something. You know, it's funny because he claims to be a big First Amendment advocate, and yet he always attacks the press. And, you know, obviously book publishers, in this case, I believe Holt is the book publisher. Book publishers are members of the press. They're not newspapers, but they certainly are. And so this fits within Trump's general pattern of going after the press and the media in the United States, only this case it happens to be a book publisher, not CNN or MSNBC.
Well, we know that Trump tried to, in fact, he got many of his senior staff in the White House to sign non-disclosure agreements. And in an interview with the Washington Post during the campaign, said that he thought that all federal employees should sign a non-disclosure agreement. So his attitudes are pretty clear. I mean, I guess coming out of business where non-disclosure agreements are common, perhaps you can cut him some slack. But non-disclosure agreements for federal employees, that's...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a different realm. And again, I think this is old Trump style. If you suggested in the business world, you can do one thing, but when you're president of the United States, you probably can't do that same thing. And I think he also feels betrayed here because my understanding is that Wolf, the author of the book, Fire and Fury, had access, significant access to the White House, you know. And I think he feels betrayed by that, by the book coming out, and feels like, I gave you access, and now you turned on me. Bannon has turned on me, and I'm going to come after you, you know, with guns a-blazing, at least legally, with Charles Harder. And it's interesting, Harder has been the attorney now for multiple high-profile plaintiffs, including Melania Trump, when she went after the Daily Mail for the article suggesting that she was an escort or a prostitute. And Harder obtained, you know, a multi $1 million settlement on that. The terms are not precisely known, but he got a settlement from that. So, and he's also represented, partners represented Hulk Hogan down here in Florida, where I am, in a case against Gawker Media when they aired a sex tape of him. So Carter is really the real deal. He's a high-profile Beverly Hills attorney who is very successful in defamation privacy cases, one of the go-to people today out there. And so, you know, Trump certainly has his attorney in line.
Well, along with the Hulk Hogan case, which put Gawker Media out of business, that was secretly financed by Peter Thiel, who was one of Trump's top campaign advisors, the Silicon Valley billionaire. Jude Law, Reese Witherspoon, Clint Eastwood, Roger Ailes, they've all been clients of Harder, a Beverly Hills high-profile libel and defamation attorney. He also, by the way, until recently, represented Harvey Weinstein.
Well, yeah, there's somebody you probably don't want to have represented at some point in time, or any point in time, for that matter.
Right. That one he's going to scrub off his resume, I'm sure. So what's your sense then of, we try to figure out why Trump did it, but are they going to follow through on this? Because the Bannon thing seems even thinner in terms of cease and desist. But
sure.
This one, obviously, as we say, you know, the book's going to be out on Friday. You can see all these people on cable TV holding the book up. So everybody in the media are reading it, you know. So it's just, there's a certain level of absurdity to all this, but what's your
sense? Exactly.
What's the legal strategy here, do you think? Or is this just a lawyer with a kind of difficult client who happens to be president of the United States and is mad as hell?
I would actually agree with everything you said in that last statement. Probably a difficult client, president of the United States, and mad as hell at this situation, and probably taking his orders, obviously, from Trump in this case, because the attorney has to follow the orders of the client. The attorney doesn't act without the client's permission or the client's instruction. So, by definition, the attorney has to be on the same page and taking you know, the instructions from the client. So I think this is simply a lot of saber-rattling here by Trump. Like I said, prior restraints on speech, stopping the publication before it can occur, that traditionally violates the First Amendment to the United States, which protects the freedom of speech and freedom of the press against government censorship. So prior restraints are typically unconstitutional. Again, the remedy here for Trump would be allow the publication to come out, which, as you just suggested, it already has. I mean, advanced copies, many advanced copies have been released. I mean, especially in the era of the Internet, it doesn't take much to scan and upload those copies so that anybody would have them. So the copies are already out. They're going to come out later this week in advance of the initial publication date. So, yes, the horse is out of the barn, and there's very little that Trump can do other than to basically raise verbal hell in this case and call out the author of the book itself, Fire and Fury and Bannon in this case. But again, were he to sue for defamation, he would have the burden of showing falsity. And I guarantee you there probably are statements in this book that are false. The question is whether those falsities would be things that would actually harm Trump's reputation. And then is Trump, as we talked about earlier, willing to undergo a deposition, which would be quite intrusive because the attorney is for the publisher of the book and the author of the book, and Bannon would be able to drill into Trump about why he believes his reputation is harmed, what the false statements were. And I don't think any president of the United States wants to have his deposition taken like that, especially in civil litigation. This is not the Lewinsky-Clinton situation where you had an independent special investigator, Ken Starr, in that case. This would be simply a one-on-one civil litigation case, very different scenario. And, you know, I think a thicker-skinned president would just basically suck it up rather than calling greater attention to the book. And obviously, you know, the irony, as we talked about, is basically helping the sales of the book out by people who would never have heard of it or not know about it or not cared about it. Now more people want to read it. So it's more likely to backfire than it is to be successful.
Well, the letter to the publisher was sent by Charles Harder, the lawyer we've been talking about, to both the author, Michael Wolff, and Steve Rubin, the president and publisher of Henry Holt & Company. But it seems like the author, Wolf, has covered himself a little bit, because in the book itself, he has a kind of caveat, I believe it's at the beginning of the book, that says the accounts that he collected, since he was hanging out in the White House for a long time, he had a kind of permanent perch there, even interviewed Trump, are collected, quote, are in conflict with one another. Many in Trumpian fashion are baldly untrue. He said that he let the players offer their versions, in turn allowing the reader to judge them, and in other instances settled on a version of events I believe to be true. So that seems to me to, I don't see it as a cop-out so much as a way to say, look, you know, I mean, it sounds like that White House is a rat's nest at any rate. They're all out stabbing each other in the back and talking out of school. So it seems like a perfectly reasonable caveat to me to say, well, I'm basically trying to report what everybody said, and then some of it doesn't add up, and you can all figure it out, and I'm trying to figure it out. What do you make of it?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, basically what he's saying is, yeah, here's what people said. I'm just a conduit. I'm not going to, you know, I'm just conveying what they said. I'm not going to be the arbiter of whether this is true or not. Kind of you can decide for yourself based on their comments. Typically, disclaimers like that really are not always very effective. The question is, would a reasonable reader take away a defamatory meaning, something that would harm the reputation of Trump? So if I were a reasonable reader of the book, I found multiple conflicting viewpoints. What would I take away? What's the meaning would I take away? That this is an assertion of fact, or is it merely one person's opinion here? It's conflicted by another opinion, and therefore, as a reasonable reader, I'm not going to take it as a statement of fact, but maybe a viewpoint, and not necessarily an assertion of this is a factual truth and it happens to be false. So again, disclaimers in libel cases don't always get the person, don't get the defendant off the hook. This is because they said, oh, it's fictionalized, or this is, you know, the conflicting viewpoints. Again, the question is, what would a reasonable reader take away? And if a reasonable reader, after reading, and it has to be taken in the entirety, so you can't take one sentence out of context. So let's say it's a chapter of the book, you'd have to read that entire chapter. You probably have to read the entire book and ask yourself at the end of that book, what would a reasonable reader take away? Is there a false statement of fact that would harm Trump's reputation here? And that, of course, would be left for a judge and the jury to decide in a libel case.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Bannon himself has not refuted any of the statements that are quoted in the book. So that's pretty telling, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think it is. I mean, and if he's not refuting anything that's in there, that suggests that he believes it's true. We don't know why, of course, he hasn't come out. Maybe he's just covering himself at this stage. Maybe he's talked to his own attorneys. You would hope that anybody involved in the situation would have talked to their own attorneys. But yes, that's a good point.
Well, Clay Calvin, I thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Clay Calvert, who is the Brechner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication, Director of the Marion B. Brechner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida. He's authored or co-authored more than 130 law journal articles on topics related to freedom of expression. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.